So, we then go back to our regular afternoon practice. And I was intending this all along. I was reflecting on what we might emphasize today. I was thinking of that yesterday. And now just all the more reason to go where I thought it might be helpful. And that is, while being here, we're not just here. If we just thought, but I'm just here, I'm just here and now, it can actually give rise to pretty strong attachment. I don't want to go. I want to be here and clinging to this. But, of course, that's not realistic. That's also a bit delusional. We're always in transition. The environment itself is in transition. We're in transition. And so, as we are still here, but it's quite natural and it's appropriate on occasion, deliberately, to let our thoughts go to the future and weave the present into the future. That what we're doing here, already in anticipation and in motivation, already thinking, when I come back, wherever we're going to, what shall I bring, what would I love to bring to those who I will very likely meet, the places I will be, the environment, the people I'll encounter, personally, in your family and so forth, professionally. It's almost like you're inviting them into the retreat, you know, in your heart, in your mind. But who will you be encountering, you know? And invite them here, in your mind's eye, these people you'll encounter, and boy, they're going to be really live, you know, 10, 11 days. And what I would suggest for this session, that we return to loving kindness. Yesterday, as you all, I'm sure, recall, we really focused primarily here, among our transient community, okay? And what I would encourage now for this next session is starting here, starting with yourself and our group here, but then cast your attention to the future. Who will you likely meet? The loved ones you'll encounter, who will see you with a big smile when you come home. They've been missing you, you know? Or maybe you'll be going to some place you've not been before. That'll be an interesting experience. You know, some people are not just going home, maybe going someplace new. But who are the kind of people, individual people, the kind of people that you'll encounter? People you feel very close to. Some may be just business people. You don't feel much strong attachment or aversion. Other people, you think, oh yeah, I need to see him or her again. Oh yeah. You know, more difficult people. And so cast your mind to the future. Not leaving Phuket, but more inviting them to Phuket, right? And then cultivate your loving kindness for each one. And I can tell you it works. It really does. That is, you'll remember, I'll bet you, that if you spend even this one session, let alone a few sessions over the next week, bringing these people to mind in this utterly, simply loving fashion, and you imagine sending them a light and wishing them well, wishing that they can find the fulfillment that they seek. If you do that, see if you don't remember it when you see them. When you encounter them, you see their face. Oh yeah, you're the real one. I was imagining you. I was attending to you. But previously it was by way of imagination. But now you're right there. You're right there. You're looking back, you know. And you'll probably remember, oh yeah, you're the one that I was really cultivating loving kindness for. And it will come. And it will flavor the meeting. Flavor the meeting with your loved ones, with simple business colleagues and so forth. And it may also flavor your encounter with people who have been but more difficult. I've been teaching this for a long time, and so many occasions when I've taught this and people have practiced it quite specifically, when they've gotten kind of the hang of it, then practicing towards people they've had difficulty with in the past. What I've heard time and again is, having done this, and then they meet the person, they find, lo and behold, the person treats them a bit differently. You can't expect it, like, you know, they're like wind-up toys. I practice now, okay, what happened to you? It's not mechanical, but it does often happen. It does often happen. And you can, and we use our old term, pratita samudpada, that as you encounter that person, there's going to be something different about, if I use a New Age term, the energy you're bringing to it, your facial expression, your body language, your tone of voice, what you actually say. You know, there's going to be something different. And people pick up on many, many levels. I read another article, written by a friend of mine, an outstanding science writer. And she was commenting that about how much of brain activity goes on that is related to consciousness, but not that we're aware of. It was something like 80%. Enormous amount of brain activity taking place when we're in deep sleep. It's not, and so the assumption was, okay, the brain is taking care of digestive tract and breathing or something like that. It turns out the brain is very, very active in deep sleep or other cases when you're out, when you're resting in the substrate consciousness. And the brain is very, very active. And it's active cognitively and not just physiologically, you know, just taking care of your internal organs or regulating them. And so, on multiple levels, we're picking up things that are not on the conscious level. And that's a scientific truth. We're picking up a lot that's not explicit. Or nanglamangepa. Nanglamangepa. Things are appearing to us, they're being taken in, but so much of it, with an enormous amount of brain activity, is not there on the conscious level. It's being taken in. So cultivate loving kindness now, and as we say, keep your eyes open. It might turn out to be a real elixir for transforming many types of relationships and engagements. The most explicit one, and this is where I'll end, but I remember once, I've been to India many times, and I always dread going through Indian customs. Maybe because the first time I ever went to India, I went there with no visa. And they thought that was not correct. They wanted to take me like football and punt me right back to Egypt, which was my last point of, you know, where I touched down. So it was kind of like nervous. I was 21 years old, and they told me, get out of our country, you know. Because I came in with no visa. I was naive. And so my very first experience was, this is nervous. These are not nice people. And like that, you know, and that became a pattern. And then after I'd been practicing for a while and I'd spent some time elsewhere, America, Europe, whatever, I came back and said, okay, Alan, it's your issue, it's not their issue. They're just doing their jobs. So, you know, I was in the airplane and thinking, I'm about to touch down at Delhi. And when you fly in from America and you land in Delhi, 1:30 in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, always. So you've just been on an airplane for maybe 20 hours, you're jet-lagged out of your mind, and you arrive at 1:30 in the morning. So it may not always bring out the best of you. But I remember once on the airplane, I said, Alan, shift your attitude. It's not their problem, it's your problem. So I meditated, got to the customs desk. Oddest thing, it was the first time in my life I'd met a really nice, friendly custom official. He really was. He was very friendly. Gracious, warm, did his business, courteous. Lucky me, huh? So let's practice this time in anticipation. Practice loving kindness. Let's settle the body, speech, and mind in the natural states. And I invite you to bring to mind your own well-being, both on the hedonic or mundane level. And with that basis, bringing to mind your own flourishing, your own genuine happiness. And I invite you, when you envision genuine happiness, flourishing, being truly well and happy, I invite you to bring to mind the quality of resilience. It is a major quality of mental health. Resilience in the face of adversity, resilience in the face of vicissitudes, of unexpected change, of unwelcome events, things we just wish were not so. Both here, in terms of the ups and downs of this retreat, but especially as you anticipate leaving here, imagine resilience. Imagine being able to face whatever reality dishes up. Responding to it with a sense of ease, of inner calm, of clarity, with an open heart, and being adaptive, being creative, imaginative, responding with compassion, responding with wisdom, without letting the mental afflictions take over and kick you back into their own ruts. Imagine your own flourishing, and with each out-breath, arouse the yearning that you may be truly well and happy. Using your imagination, imagine that it is so. You may, to the extent that you wish, imagine difficult or challenging situations, and imagine rising up to meet them, taking them in stride, receiving them as blessings to further you on your own path to the realization of your own fulfillment. And then turn your awareness to the future. Bring to mind those people you're likely to encounter. And as you've done so many times in the past, wish each one well. And let's continue practicing in silence. And let's bring the session to a close. Naso. So, we're going to start with the ever so notorious Noah, who's given us one juicy question after another. I've read through it already, and I thought what I'd really like to do is to just send you a message right back. And the message would read, Noah Rosetter, your mission, if you wish to accept it, is to achieve gold-like bodhicitta in this lifetime. Your mission, not quite impossible, but definitely a big challenge. Because Noah's question here is about this this bodhicitta actually realizing bodhicitta and actually becoming a bodhisattva. So the question to read it here is, if you've achieved shamatha and have a strong desire to attain irreversible bodhicitta as quickly as possible, what practices would you apply? This is a multiple part question. You're of course very well equipped now with a mind that is serviceable. It's a very prosaic term, but lesuruma, a mind that really works, right? So, and of course the body, the mind, malleable and all of that. So what would you do? There are many, many classic teachings on this. Now we've gone absolutely mainstream. Now you've in raising this question for all of Mahayana Buddhism, you've now entered a real mainstream kind of question for which there are lots and lots of teachings. Lots and lots of teachings. Classic teachings from the Mahayana Sutras, from the great commentaries from India, from the great commentaries and sub-commentaries and meditation manuals from Tibet. It's a wealth, it's an ocean of material you can deal with. And so, but to give a brief answer, because this could be a one-year answer, right? To make sure that just as in the shamatha, we have the depth of the relaxation and the stability and the heights of the vividness, to spend some time learning, it's not just a really great sense of compassion and caring a whole lot. It is something very explicit. It is an aspiration to achieve perfect enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Well, that has to have some flesh on it. That's a skeleton. What do you mean by perfect enlightenment? Well, there's a lot there. There's a lot there. You can read about it in the Pali Canon. That's the most undisputed body of teachings from the Buddha. Nobody, you know, no Buddhist that I know of around the world, at least no whole schools of Buddhism, says, oh, no, that's suspect, we don't, you know, the Nikaya is the core discourses of the Buddha. That's consensual. And then the many, many discourses in the Mahayana that are about bodhicitta, bodhisattva way of life. Learn as much as you can. Not to become a great scholar, but, you know, to be well informed. What is it to be a Buddha, right? So you know what you're aspiring for. That's not just some kind of a vacuous notion. And when you get that kind of, you get the target, almost like the North Star, like you're navigating. Okay, that's the North Star. I get it. I won't forget it. That's it. I know where I'm going. Then I would come back to the depth. So now that's almost like the vividness as a corollary. Then I come back to, it's just the corollary of relaxation. It's not relaxation. But that is come back to the themes of, in Tibetan it's called Ngenjung, which is the spirit of definite emergence, or it's simply called renunciation. What is the scope of suffering? When you say, I wish to liberate all sentient beings from suffering, to bring each one to enlightenment. Okay, what do you mean by suffering? And then not just to indeed have a conceptual understanding, but then really to meditate in some depth. What is the scope, the breadth, the depth, the range of suffering to which we are in? So what am I taking on here? What is this really about? And take it on for yourself. And so as you cultivate this strong, powerful yearning to be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering yourself, and you really get it, at that point, far beyond anything I envisioned when I was 22, 23, and this person told me, you're practicing Dharma because there's nothing else to do. When this spirit of renunciation or a spirit of definite emergence arises, it is just simply, that's it. There, it just isn't anything else to do except for practice Dharma, devote yourself with everything you can, full throttle, as if your hair is on fire. That was the Buddha's metaphor. But to see that this is absolutely authentic for yourself. It's not just a really swell thing to do for other people, but this is the only thing to do for yourself. Finally, let's just get real. You've always wanted to be free of suffering. We've always wanted to find happiness. Now let's just be real, absolutely and continuously real, authentic, identifying the true causes of suffering, the true causes of happiness, full throttle, develop this yearning. As Shantideva says in that first chapter, if you don't even envision the benefits of bodhicitta for yourself, then why would you ever cultivate it for anybody else? So it's envisioning the benefits of bodhicitta for yourself, envisioning the benefits of enlightenment for yourself. And that is not selfish. In Tibetan, it's randu and jendu. It is your own self-interest and the interest of others. And your self-interest counts. Your self-interest counts. It is worthy to aspire for enlightenment, for liberation, for your own well-being. It's not selfish. It is taking into account your own, that you're a sentient being. This is worthy. And then you expand it. So it's like goes into one, and then it goes out in all directions and embraces all others. So to learn, what is this really about? What is the nature of bodhicitta? What is the nature of suffering? What is the nature of liberation? Nature of the enlightenment of a Buddha? Cultivating this profound renunciation for yourself. And then, just as we've done for loving kindness, as for me, so for every other sentient being. The whole range of sentient beings, not only human beings. All sentient beings have Buddha nature. And expand your awareness. Expand your awareness. But now, optimally, to my mind, and this goes back to Atisha. I mean, I so revere Atisha. But he was the one that made the ironic. You might have noticed by now, I kind of like irony. And I guess Atisha must have as well. Because he said, oh, you Tibetans are the only people who know how to develop bodhicitta without developing the four immeasurables. That was irony. And so really spending time cultivating the soil, going deeper and deeper. And that's what I would suggest. There are many ways. That's the first answer. That's really, now that I've gone on for 5 minutes, the first answer is there are multiple ways. There's not just one strategy. Like we have dozens of different ways of achieving shamatha. There's not just one avenue. But my own predilection for people the likes of us, where I think experience is one of the great motivators, you know, spending really cultivating those four immeasurables until the barriers are broken down. That's what I would do. Just let alone maha maitri, maha karuna, just how about immeasurable loving kindness and immeasurable compassion. And see that you've done, you know, before moving into high school of bodhicitta, you've really covered the bases in elementary school of broken down all the barriers. That heart is open equally in loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, wherever it just flows spontaneously, that equanimity, the evenness of it all. I think if one really spent time doing that, and with the power of samadhi, that would be monumental. Monumental. Gosh, if we had an observatory where we had a bunch of people achieving shamatha and then doing that, I think it would just start transforming the whole environment. I think the impact of that. And this is the teachings of the Buddha. It's not just encapsulated or, how do you say, encased within your skin. You start developing bodhicitta or loving kindness, compassion on that, to that depth. Start influencing the environment. Influences animals. And there's empirical evidence for that. Shantideva was one. Shantideva, after achieving bodhicitta, big time bodhisattva, he disappeared from his monastery. And he just decided, okay, he'd written his great texts, two classic texts. And he went off, he took off his robes per se and just traveled incognito as just a beggar. Just disappeared into the crowd, you know. And then after a while, he took up residence in a cave and he was just meditating there. And so people knew he was a yogi. I don't know if they even knew that he was a monk. But some people saw animals were coming into his cave and they weren't coming out. So the word got around, hey, there's a yogi over there. He's killing animals. Poor animals come in, he slaughters them, chowing down on their flesh. And so they went to investigate. The animals were just coming in for company. They just wanted to be around him. You know? And there's so many cases. This is just true. You don't have to be, you know, you can be religious, not religious, I don't care, that's your business. But this is true. This happens. There's lots of evidence. And of course, it's not confined to Buddhism. Buddhism has no, how do you, monopoly on compassion. I mean, you have to be thinking of St. Francis. You know, but it's not just one or two people. It influences on a very deep level the whole environment. So I would say cultivate richly those four immeasurables until you really, it's brimming over there in equanimity, which is so full of heart, so full of heart. And then, so here's my suggestion. There are many ways. Here's my suggestion in terms of strategy. Cultivate those four immeasurables until the barriers are all broken down, and they're all immeasurable. And you'll be one of the happiest people on the planet, right there. You'll be just so full of joy. So you almost won't be able to stand it, because it's just going to flow out, you know. And people want to be near you, just to be in your presence. It's true. That's not religious belief. It's just true. And then go on and cultivate great loving kindness. And then you're reaching, now you're going down to the depths, now you're going down to your stem, down to your Buddha nature, and you're arousing that. May all beings be totally free of suffering. All beings find the greatest happiness. And may I make it so. May I make it so. Just cultivate that. And now you're just going down to the tap root, down to your Buddha nature. Because as I said before, that's the only dimension from which this is realistic. And then taking stock of reality and saying, but how can that be realistic? Gosh, what they're actually experiencing, this world of sentient being, I mean, this is what I would love for them to experience. And then, oh, that's not what's happening. Ocean of suffering. Almost inconceivable suffering. Oh, okay. May all sentient beings be free of suffering. May I make it so. Cultivate great compassion. Great compassion. And from that, when it's just stirring, you just feel it. It's genuine. You actually feel, and this is where you, I think, absolutely catalyze your Buddha nature. When you arouse that motivation, that resolve, it's more than a motivation. I shall liberate all sentient beings. And you feel, and yes, I will. And yes, I will. That can only come from that depth. Then you're thinking from your Buddha nature. You're resolving, you're intending from your Buddha nature. That's deep. And it's real. It says, yes, I know it's going to take a long time. I'm not holding my breath. I'm going to breathe all the way through it. But, and it's so hard to say, just to recite this verse without becoming overwhelmed, but I'll do my best. But for as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, so long shall I remain to alleviate the suffering of the world. And it's real. We actually mean it. When you see a bodhisattva like His Holiness, and you see, you just listen to him, because he recites this frequently. Well, he means it. He really means it. What resolve. That's divine. So it makes me think of the Kala Chakra statement, there are no Buddhas apart from sentient beings. That's divine. And so when it comes there, then consider, that's my resolve. And that's almost like having a plan, like wanting to build the Phuket International Academy. I'm resolved to do it. Klaus must have come to that conclusion at one point. And obviously this is a tiny microcosm. But it's a pretty big plan here. And at some point, Klaus must have simply resolved. The school, the sports and leisure club, he and I met. Okay, the mind center. There was a resolve, no question about it. And Klaus, this is the nature of Klaus. He makes a decision, he makes a resolve, and you just consider it's done. Unless he dies, something just catastrophic happens. He is a man of his word. I mean, he carries through. He's well known for that. And so, fine. Good. And now how are you going to do it? How do you make that practical? As you develop out of this resolve of great compassion, this exalted resolve, that may I liberate all sentient beings from suffering, bring each one to their highest fulfillment, this laksam, this extraordinary resolve. Once you've developed that, and that's spontaneous, it's real, it's real. You actually mean it. Just like, I will give you my case. I can, I will, I intend to. That's something I can definitely do. In a similar fashion, this is what I'll do. And I know the magnitude of it. This is not nebulous, woolly thinking. How to make that practical? Now, what's the strategy? Because it's not enough to have a resolve. So Klaus had to have a strategy. Who are the contractors? Who's the architects? Who's the interior design? Who's the gardeners? The landscaping? And all of that. Have to have a plan. Otherwise, the resolve is kind of vacuous. And then you say, okay, how is it practical? Well, that's easy. I've got to be a Buddha. I have to be a Buddha. Otherwise, how am I going to lead other people to Buddhahood if I don't become a Buddha myself? Right? So, and that's where bodhicitta comes. And now with all of that background, and now here's my resolve. And when you want to make it so it almost reverberates out in the atmosphere around you, you either do so in the front of preferably a great being like the Dalai Lama, but in any case, someone who has the Bodhisattva precept, or you can actually do it on your own, and you simply imagine being in the presence of the Buddha as your witness, as like a notary public. You are my witness. And either with an actual person or simply visualize, but imagining the Buddha being present with you, then in the presence of the Buddha, you're about to make a vow. You say, in the presence of the Buddha, this is my vow, this is my resolve. However long it takes, whether it's one lifetime or three countless eons, whatever, I resolve to become fully awakened in order to be of greatest possible benefit to the world. And that's bodhicitta. And so we cultivate until it just becomes more and more spontaneous. It arises more easily, more readily, more just effortlessly. And it said when you're getting to the point where it's just now is becoming spontaneous, it's called in Tibetan jumamayimba, uncontrived, unmanufactured, uneffortful. It just flows like water. It said that the littlest thing, just a little catalyst here or there, seeing the dog yelping and seeing it run there, or reading an article in the New York Times, I'm not in any way saying, oh, that I'm a bodhisattva, forget about it. But reading something like that, oh, the only way they're treating ADHD was just with drugs. And just, and it catalyzes. So it's almost like anything can touch you off and spark that bodhicitta again, right? So that would be one way. In terms of actual method, Donglen, of course, is very good. But in order to have full depth, I think full foundation in the four measurables, the great loving kindness, great compassion, the extraordinary resolve, and then bodhicitta. That's pretty classic. Pretty classic. Nothing's missing for strategy. But the question goes on, is there a radical shift in the attainment of earth-like or gold-like bodhicitta, the first phase, the second phase of bodhicitta, as there is in the achievement of shamatha? Or is it possible to be a bodhisattva and not know it? That's a very good question. So in terms of the, is it like a moment? The question was very well articulated. My sense is it's not as dramatic as like 2 o'clock on Tuesday, you know, because there's this, you don't kind of more or less feel a pressure on your head for 2 weeks, you know. That's something very distinct. And then the shifts in the shift in the mind, the shift in the body, back to the shift of mind, and that's a real event. You know, that's something really has parameters. Okay, it took so long, however many minutes or whatever. Bodhicitta, the achievement, I think the real question here is the earth-like, because that's when you first become a bodhisattva. Yeah, and so maybe we'll just stick with this question and the other two can wait until tomorrow, because this is a very rich one, as usual. I think the question really is this spontaneously arising bodhicitta, when you actually become a bodhisattva. Is it as distinct as the shamatha? Crossing the threshold, your mind shifts from the desire realm to the form realm. I've never seen any account of it that would suggest it's quite as distinct, as clear-cut as that. I've never seen. I have, whether it's Shantideva, or I've read a lot of texts, received many teachings on bodhicitta, but I'm sure I've heard this, that when it arises spontaneously, that you really have become a bodhisattva. It's said that the devas just start, devas, the bodhisattvas and so forth, they throw a party, you know, like, another one's become a bodhisattva, you know, and they party, you know, like, celebration, flowers falling and so forth and so on, because it's such a big deal. So, but of course, that's not something that, you know, ordinary mortals can perceive. So, I think not quite as distinct, not quite so clear-cut. But then we move into the area, and that is, do you find that motivation just arises spontaneously? It's catalyzed by almost anything without effort. It's just, whew. Or Shantideva, when he speaks of the two types of bodhicitta, the aspiring bodhicitta, where it's really in the mode of aspiration, and then the engaging bodhicitta. Or the engaging, where it's now fully in gear. As you engage with, you're walking here, you're seeing the pregnant kitty there, you're eating here, you're engaging with a cook there, that it's just, what Shantideva says is when you enter into that engaged bodhicitta, jukpe semke, engaged bodhicitta, he said that it's a flow, it's a current, it's continuous. And it's continuous if at the end of a long day you feel kind of like you're, let's say you're not here, you're home and you're just doing more ordinary things. At the end of the day, you just kind of kick back and say, oh, I'm pretty tired. That was a long day. What's on television? Oh, there's a nice documentary, nice nature documentary or whatever. Yeah, that'd be nice. Let's just watch that. Or maybe there's some fun movie. It's entertainment, but it's not bad. There's nothing, you know, nothing nasty about it. It's just good entertainment. You sit back and you watch, let's say just an entertainment movie. Let's not make this too elite. Just a good old movie. While you're watching the movie, you're generating merit. Because why are you doing this? So you can restore your vitality, you can get yourself refreshed, and you can come back and carry on in your path. So this is too, is part of your path, to kick back once in a while. So Shantideva says, even when you're resting, the flow of bodhicitta continues, continues, continues. And so what would that be experienced like? I've never seen any really clear account, but that's one point, that it flows. You're really in a current. So in the Shravakayana, or I've often used the word early Buddhism, which is not so terribly good term, but on this path of one's own individual liberation, you become a stream enterer, and that would give some sense. You're now in the current. You're flowing towards nirvana, and there's no way back. You will achieve nirvana within not too long a time. But it's just guaranteed now. You will achieve nirvana, and within a very finite period, not three countless eons. And so it's something like being in a stream as well, it seems, from the writings of Shantideva. One other point that's quite interesting, learned this many, many years ago, is once that bodhicitta is really arising spontaneously, he said the level of mental suffering pretty much goes flat, but with a caveat, that is with a qualifier, yeah, and that is self-centered. Oh, I'm so disappointed I didn't get that. Oh, I hope that would happen. That didn't happen. Oh, this person really abused me. That was really wrong. I didn't. All the kind of the frustration, the anxiety, the misery, the unhappiness, disappointment, so forth. That's about me. Gone, gone, gone. Pretty much none. One might, like the Dalai Lama, one might weep on occasion. But I've never seen him weep for himself. Oh, poor me. I've lost my country. Oh, I had so much more stuff when I was in Tibet. Never happens, you know. I've seen him weep on more than one occasion, but it's never about himself. Sometimes out of gratitude, sometimes out of reverence, sometimes out of sadness. But it was always sadness for others. Yeah. That can happen. That'll go on. So if we bracketed this, so that would be something of that earth-like, the sattva-samkhya, the earth-like bodhicitta. But now for this goal-like bodhicitta to arise, which is now the irreversible phase, as you well know, This suggests now that this great heart, this jewel-like mind, Rinchen Sem, Shantideva calls it jewel mind, this jewel mind, bodhicitta. He said, so for that to be irreversible, that jewel mind, bodhicitta, then needs to be, in a way, protected with insight. And so, but the insight that's a gradient. It's not saying, what it does absolutely not say is, oh, it has to be protected with unmediated, non-conceptual, non-dual realization of emptiness. That's not true. No, you don't need that depth. You don't need to have realized nirvana. It would be, what's explicitly referred to is the four satipatthana, the four applications of mindfulness, some real experience, some genuine insight into impermanence, nature of suffering, and nature of non-self. Okay? But that protects it. It's almost like the guardians around it. Like no mara, no adversity, no mental affliction will be able to come in and kill the king. These bodyguards, they're like the Swiss guard. You're not getting through them. Not with that type of, you know. Shamatha protects them, but vipassana protects the bodhicitta, right? So what's that like? I would imagine, have to choose my words carefully here. It's just a profound sense of confidence. It's irreversible. You know it. You know it. Doesn't matter what you witness, what you hear about, the atrocities, the terrible things that human beings sometimes do to each other. You know it's protected. If we bracketed that, because I thought as I was reflecting, I did read this before we came here. If we consider insight into impermanence, into suffering, into non-self, it's not all or nothing. And that is, you'll have insight, there's just no question about this, you'll have insights into impermanence. There's coarse impermanence, there's subtle impermanence. Buddha Gosin, the Visuddhimagga, gives, he describes extremely subtle, samadhi-powered type of insight into impermanence, where the focus of your attention is in terms of the momentary arising of not only the mind, but of all phenomena. As you attend to another person, whatever, there's a moment of arising and then a moment of passing, and it's all staccato. There's a way of finessing that, that in this powerful laser-like samadhi that you're bringing to bear, in terms of the arising moment and the subsiding moment, and that's a finite period, right? You attend to the subsiding moment. You just, like a fast frame projector, you're attending to the disillusion, 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 and that's it. You're getting samadhi on the disillusion factor. The apparently, from that type of insight, where it's just samadhi powered, the sense of disillusion with samsara and the burning away, it's like you bring a blowtorch to any vestige of attachment, to anything. It's just all gone. It can't stand that. Because you see, anything you might even be arising to have some attachment for, you're just focusing on it falling apart, dissipating, dissipating, dissipating. What are you going to hold to? It's going. It's all going. Everything is going. It can be traumatic. It's very existential. That you see, everything's going. Everything's going. I'm going. The mind is going. Body's going. Everybody around me is going. It's all going, going, going. Attachment can't handle that, you know. So, and that's just impermanence. To fathom the level of dukkha, to fathom non-self, many gradations. And so, and then there's a point of becoming stream enterer. Well, okay, now using those as a vehicle, you've now gained unmediated, non-conceptual, non-dual realization of emptiness, of nirvana, right? That's powerful. That's one of those big transitions. And as I was trying to think of a metaphor, it would be like going up in a helicopter or an air balloon, you know, hot air balloon, but coming up through layers and layers and layers of clouds. Often in an airplane, you can see like the three layers of clouds. And coming up, and you're seeing the sun, but through layers and layers and layers. And then finally, let's say the air balloon comes up above all distortion. I mean, maybe you're 75,000 feet up. But at one point, let's just imagine that when you're going through the hot air balloon, you see the sun, and then it's the layers of obscuration getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and then, and this, it's only a metaphor, so that means it's limited, but at some point, whew, no mediation, no separation, no veiling, you are nirvana. Not that it's a person, but it's just an utterly non-dual, absolutely unmediated. And that's a breakthrough. So you've had a whole drum roll, but that's true for shamatha too. You've had all kinds of shifts in the prana, you've had bliss, you've had luminosity, you've had non-conceptuality, you've had it all, but still there's this big discontinuity when you actually achieve it. And likewise for vipassana. Many, many insights. And then just... And it's interesting that in vipassana, as for shamatha, a radical transformation of body and mind, once again, xinjiang, huakdonggi xinjiang, the suppleness, buoyancy, malleability, the lightness of vipassana, and the joy of vipassana. Now also, the bliss is qualitatively different. One would think, well, I was quite happy with shamatha, actually, you know, that was pretty darn good. But you'll find the quality of bliss of vipassana is greater. It's greater. It's deeper. The other one stemming from substrate consciousness. The other one's coming from knowing reality as it is. So that would be, yes, gradation, 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 and then whoo, bottom drops out. And then why not? How about rikpa? So that's not the same as emptiness. Unconditioned mind, referred to in the Pali Canon. But in the Mahayana, unlike in the Pali Canon, It's a significant difference in the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, the Dzogchen. Very clear, unequivocal. It is possible while you still have a body, before you have died as an arhat, while you're a bodhisattva, while, even without bodhicitta, you may realize, how do you say, without having bodhicitta already, you may have a realization of this utterly transcendent, unconditioned dimension of awareness, which we call Rigpa. But now, is that all or nothing? The answer is it's not all or nothing. You may go to a truly realized Lama, like the late Dingo Kenzi, the late Dujum Rinpoche, and others like Akalu Rinpoche, great Mahamudra master, who are living in, dwelling in that realization. They may give you a pointing out instruction, if you're very fortunate. And as they're giving the pointing out instruction, and you're simply being receptive, you're open to it, you may receive something right there. And it's a breakthrough. It's an unprecedented experience. And you recognize when you have it that this is of incomparable value. Incomparable value. That you've come now to the very source of meaning. Right? Does this mean you're a vidyadhara? A vidyadhara, now you are, you know, a great holder of Rigpa. No. Was it just an illusion? Was it just a fabrication? No. Did you realize Rigpa? You got a taste. And then the practice is sustain it. Sustain it. And then once again, it's if you have the power of shamatha behind it, and it's not locked out or blocked by reifying phenomena. In other words, if you come there prepared with shamatha and vipassana, then this is not going to be that hard. If you get the pointing out instruction, you realize it, then your practice is simple. You just sustain. You simply sustain your awareness of Rigpa. That's it. You don't have any other practice. That's it. And you just, it's like, you've given the taste, okay, now stay with that. And now just watch it deepen. Just watch it deepen. Now it's non-meditation, ma gom sangye, Buddhahood without meditation. This is where it really kicks in. You've already achieved shamatha, you've achieved vipassana. Good, now practice non-meditation by not doing anything at all except for being Rigpa. And then it gets clearer and clearer and clearer. The conceptual layers, vestiges of grasping, dissipate. You become a vidyadhara. And then that's, unmediated realization of Rigpa. Okay? So a gradient, but a discontinuity. Something like that. I have to add that I don't know what I'm talking about. But I think the words are okay. Is there any way of telling how long it might take, like with shamatha, 5 to 10,000 hours? There's no guarantee about shamatha even. I mean, just bear in mind, for bracketing, Gautama achieved it by sitting down under a rose apple tree. I want to find that rose apple tree. Where is that rose apple tree? and Atisha says that if you don't have the prerequisite, you can practice for 1,000 years and not achieve it. And some people are more gifted, some people less gifted. Just like for piano, like music, art, mathematics, anything else. It's the karma, it's the vasana, the bhaksha, the mental imprints from past life. Some people will go very fast, some people slower. So no guarantee it would be 5,000 hours. To say 5,000 hours is a good order of magnitude, that you would be absolutely exceptional if you achieved shamatha in 500 hours. That'd be like a really good 8-week retreat, right? Something like that. Then, way to go, dude. If you took 50,000 hours, I think, wow, why that long? Did you practice a long time without having made sure all the prerequisites were there? Do you have a lot of obstacles? What came up? That's kind of like, that's long, 50,000 hours. 5,000 hours, probably, it's the right order of magnitude, right? So, but for bodhicitta, I don't know. But I do feel confident that if you prepared the ground with shamatha and the four immeasurables, and you embed it in a rich context, a worldview that's supportive. At this point, I would say Buddhist worldview. Not because I'm trying to now finally, convert us? It's not that. It's just that if this is your resolve, then how can you not rely upon and trust yourself to those who have achieved what you're resolved to achieve? It doesn't make any sense. And that's all being a Buddhist means, is you're entrusting your spiritual life, your quest for genuine happiness, to those who are fully enlightened. So then to dwell in as much as possible, not by a leap of faith, not by just assuming a lot of dogma, embracing beliefs that one doesn't understand, never has to come up, but with careful investigation, as you have. I mean, all of your questions are spot on. None of these are blind faith kind of questions. But embracing a worldview that will support you at every turn in this. Scientific materialism doesn't do that. It supports materialistic values, big time. It supports a consumer-oriented way of life, big time, fantastically successful. It supports massive consumption and massive acquisition. It's terrific for that. I mean, they fit like hand in glove. So materialistic worldview, materialistic values, and a consumer-oriented way of life, they just fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. Boy, do they belong to each other. And they absolutely reinforce each other. Totally. Well, likewise, a worldview of the Buddha, the values of one who's of the Bodhisattva values, and Bodhisattva way of life absolutely reinforce each other. Just utterly reinforce. So you're getting help from all sides. So that would be very helpful. And what I was going to say is you've achieved shamatha, and then you embrace a Buddha worldview, Bodhisattva values, Buddha values, way of life, then, and with the groundwork of the Four Immeasurables, I would say, it won't take you too long. And you'll love it, every moment of it. It'll be rich, it'll be tremendously meaningful, and you won't be looking at your wristwatch. You won't be asking, are we there yet? Because it'll be so profoundly good, you'll know that no matter how long it takes, this is absolutely a value. Something like that. Hola, so. Thank you. Very good question, as always.